You know, most popular dramatic stories have good guys and bad guys. That's usually kind of the premise of the whole plot, whether it's a movie, a book, a television program. There is this struggle between good guys and bad guys, and we always root for the good guys. I remember watching television with my father. I was maybe 5 years old, and the old black and white TV where you could just barely even make out the picture. But there were a lot of Westerns on TV back in those early days. Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, Hopalong Cassidy. There were a number of heroic cowboys back in those days. And my father pointed out to me, much to my disappointment, that the good guys wore white hats and the bad guys wore black hats. And sure enough, as I was watching the programs, that usually seemed to be pretty much the way that it was. Now, the reason that disappointed me was that at the age of 5, what I wanted for my birthday was a cap gun, a little pistol with a holster, and a cowboy hat. And I wanted my cowboy hat to be black. So to be told that that would make me a bad guy was kind of disappointing, but a little exciting at the same time. And I also wanted a cowboy hat that did not have that silly little chin strap, because that's what girls wore. Boys did not have a chin strap on their cowboy hat. You see these girls on horses and they're right galloping along and the hat flies back and it's on their neck. The guys just put their head down and ride their horse into the wind and they don't have any problem at all. For my 5th birthday, I got the cap gun and holster, and I got a cowboy hat, complete with a chin strap. I finally talked my mother into cutting the chin strap off of it, but it was really disappointing to me to find out about the good guy, bad guy thing. Of course, things change over the years. In Star Wars, the bad guys are stormtroopers, and they're entirely covered in white armor, and they're the bad guys. It really kind of gets hard to tell who's who anymore. Now, the Bible has its stories also. Often, Bible stories also are about good guys versus bad guys, righteousness versus evil. From the beginning, there was Cain and Abel. There were the Egyptians versus the Israelites. Saul versus David. David versus Goliath. Good guys and bad guys. And we find ourselves rooting for the good guys. About 2,200 years ago, the good guys of the nation of Judah were up against some really, really bad guys from Syria. Now, it took about 3 years for it all to play out, but eventually the good guys won. And now the Jews have an annual 8-day celebration that memorializes their victory. Last night marked the conclusion of this year's celebration. At sunset last night, that Jewish festival came to an end, just as the weekly Sabbath was beginning. And we even find a reference in the Gospel of John to Jesus being at one of those celebrations. Turn with me to John chapter 10. John chapter 10, verse 22. John 10, verse 22. Now it was the feast of dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Jesus was at Jerusalem, at the temple, at the time of the feast of dedication. Now it doesn't say why Jesus was there. It doesn't say that he was participating in the celebration, But it does seem that he made a special effort to be in Jerusalem on that occasion. The title of the sermon today is The Feast of Dedication. Jesus was there, and it says that he was on Solomon's porch, and it says it was in the winter. The Feast of Dedication takes place every year, usually in early to middle December. Solomon's porch was an extensive, covered, open-air area on the perimeter, on the east side of the temple structure. And it had a very high cover to it, supported by massive columns. It was one of the more impressive views of the temple. When you consider the context of this setting here in John chapter 10, it looks pretty certain that this would have been in the winter of 30 AD, just a few months before the Passover of 31 AD, when Jesus would be crucified. On this occasion, while Jesus was in Jerusalem at the time of the Feast of Dedication, he was challenged, as he often was, by the Jews. Verse 24, the Jews surrounded him and said to him, "How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly." The people were still demanding him, even this far, into his ministry, and most of them were not able to figure out if he really was the Messiah that they had been looking for. I'm not going to read verses 25 through 39. You can take a look at that. In this section, Jesus says, "Look, if I tell you, you're not going to understand or believe me anyway, because you are not my sheep." And in this context, he speaks of God the Father as his Father. He didn't say that he was Messiah, but he did say that God was his Father. The Jews were enraged, as they had been before, by this same claim. And they tried to seize him. They were looking to kill him. They were looking to stone him for blasphemy, for what he had said. But it says in verse 39 that he was able to escape. Another confrontation between a good guy and some bad guys. What I want to do today is to explore a bit of history. Why were the Jews celebrating the Feast of Dedication? And are there any lessons that we can learn from their observance of this time? Well, to study this little bit of history, we have to first go back to Daniel chapter 8 and take a look at some prophecy. Daniel chapter 8. In this portion of Daniel, there's a prophecy that is very much like the prophecy that's in Daniel 2. Chapters 7 and 8, it talks about this series of world-dominating empires that would come through the ages. And we're going to break into the middle of the story. We don't have time to review all of the context. But in chapter 8, it is a prophecy of the rise of the Greek Empire. The Greek Empire replaced the Persian Empire, and the Greek Empire is represented in chapter 7 as a leopard, because it was able to advance so quickly. And it mentions something similar to that here in chapter 8. Here it's compared to a male goat. Beginning in verse 5, a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between its eyes. This is a prophecy of Alexander the Great, whose Greek Empire defeated the Persian Empire and very rapidly moved through and conquered nations to become established. It's compared, it says that it moved without touching the ground. In other words, again, highlighting or just emphasizing the speed at which Alexander the Great was able to conquer the rest of the known world. Drop down to verse 8. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. You may recall that Alexander the Great died at a young age, 33 years of age when he died. And his empire was divided between four generals that were leaders of his forces. So this is a prophecy of the death of Alexander the Great, and he is replaced. He's the large horn that is broken, and in place come four notable ones who would then divide the Greek empire between or among themselves. Verse 9, and out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. This little horn, this is a prophecy, but now this is a part of this prophecy has been fulfilled. This little horn was fulfilled by a man named Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. You more than likely are familiar with that name. There was a line of kings of the Antiochus house, and this is the fourth, Antiochus the Fourth, who is this little horn that is in verse 9. He fulfilled this part of the prophecy. He's called Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Epiphanes is a title which he gave to himself. And the meaning of that word is God manifest. In other words, he considered himself to be a god. And he took that title very presumptuously upon himself. He was one of the four generals who divided the Greek Empire on the death of Alexander, and he was the king of what was the Seleucid Empire, and that's primarily the nation of Syria. So he grew exceedingly great toward the south and east and toward the glorious land, or toward the Holy Land, toward Palestine. Verse 11, he even exalted himself as high as the priest of the host. In other words, again, he considered himself to be God or a God. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn, that's Antiochus, to oppress the daily sacrifices. And he cast truth down to the ground. And he did all this, and he prospered. In other words, he was successful at the damage that he was doing to the Holy Land, to Jerusalem in particular, and actually causing the daily sacrifices to cease. So Antiochus is the bad guy in this story. There's quite a lot of detail to him and his what he was like and the things that he did, the things that he was responsible for. But we're going to keep it in a pretty simple story for today. And in the winter of 167 B.C., he invaded the Holy Land. He invaded Jerusalem. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of God's sanctuary was cast down. It says that this was done because of transgression. So apparently the people of Judah were not entirely faithful to their covenant with God. We know their history. There were times when they were more responsive to God than others. This happens, it says, because of sins of the people. But Antiochus was very brutal as he invaded the city. He desecrated the temple. He prevented the Jews from offering their sacrifices on the altar. And as an intentional insult to the Jews, he sacrificed swine on their sacred altar. Other than the destruction of Solomon's temple some 400 years earlier, this was one of the darkest times to this point in the history of Judah. And for 3 years, Antiochus was successful. The sacrifices ceased, and those who practiced the Jewish religion were persecuted to the extreme. William Barclay, in his comments on John 10, in his daily Bible study series, summarizes the brutal and tragic events of that time that were inflicted on the Jews in Jerusalem. Here's how it reads. It was 167 BC when Antiochus attacked Jerusalem. It was said that 80,000 Jews perished, and as many were sold into slavery. The sum of 1,800 talents was stolen from the temple treasury. 1,800 talents. One talent was the equivalent of 15 years' wages for the average laborer. So 1,800 talents were taken from the treasury. A huge amount of wealth was taken from the temple. Continuing with Barclay's comments, it became a capital offense to possess a copy of the law or to circumcise a child. Mothers who did circumcise their children were crucified with their children hanging around their necks. The temple courts were profaned. The temple chambers were turned into brothels. And finally, Antiochus took the dreadful step of turning the great altar of the burnt offering into an altar to the Olympic god Zeus, and on it proceeded to offer swine's flesh to the pagan gods. Other books describe in gruesome detail the history of what happened in this time. Josephus writes of it in his histories. There's also a book in the Apocrypha called Second Maccabees, which includes details of the conditions when the city was invaded by Antiochus. In 2 Maccabees chapter 7, there's a description of a mother who was forced to watch the torture and death of her 7 adult sons, one at a time, because they refused to eat swine's flesh. And then she herself, after witnessing this horrible scene, was tortured and killed. Frankly, that chapter in Maccabees is so disturbing that I've chosen not to read it as part of the sermon. You could look it up and read it if you would choose to. Whether it's literally true or not, I don't know, because the book of Maccabees is not scripture. We don't know if the history is true and correct. But it does illustrate the brutality of the Syrians and their efforts to destroy the Jewish religion and Jewish people. And it also illustrates the faithfulness and the courage that Jews had who refused to submit to Antiochus. In Daniel 8 again, verse 13. Daniel 8, verse 13. I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking. In other words, you've got two angels having a conversation, is what's being described here. So one asked the other, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot? One is asking the other, how long is this going to continue? And he said to me, verse 14, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary will be cleansed. So this desecration and this terrible persecution was to continue for a specific period of time. The original Hebrew text of verse 14 says 2,300 evenings and mornings. 2,300 evenings and mornings. Now at the temple there was a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice. So 2,300 mornings and evenings means 1,150 days of sacrifices, since there were two each day. And then the sanctuary would be cleansed and restored. So God was not going to allow this terrible situation to continue indefinitely. In fact, shortly after the invasion, a priest named Matthias Maccabeus led a band of Jews in a rebellion against the Syrians. He was able, through very careful military tactics, to have quite an impact on the Syrian army. Within a year, he himself died, and he left the battle and the leadership of the Jews to his son, Judas Maccabeus, who went on to defeat the Syrians and to take back the temple. Here's a description that's part of the story of this time from the History Channel website. It says, led by the Jewish priest Matthias and his five sons, a large-scale rebellion broke out against Antiochus and the Seleucid monarchy. When Matthias died in 166 BC, his son Judas, known as Judas Maccabee the Hammer, took the helm. He probably could have been a wrestler. Judas Maccabee the Hammer is what he was known as. And within two more years, so Matthias was led the rebellion for 1 year. He died, his son took over, and within two more years, the Jews had successfully driven the Syrians out of Jerusalem, relying largely on guerrilla warfare tactics. So under the leadership of Judas Maccabee, the temple was regained, and then it could be restored. The rededication of the temple was in 164 BC. 3 years after the initial invasion, which fulfilled the prophecy of Daniel 8. And Judas Maccabeus instituted a celebration called Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a Hebrew word that means dedication. The Feast of Dedication, mentioned in John chapter 10, is Hanukkah, which was established after the temple was restored in the time of Judas Maccabeus. By the way, I'm not trying to pronounce the Hebrew word correctly. There's an Israeli news publication called Haaretz, which says that proper pronunciation of Hanukkah begins with a guttural sound, which, quote, often is described as the kind you might make if you had a fishbone stuck in the back of your throat. The Hebrew language is very guttural, and lacking any fishbones to store in the back of my throat, I'm not going to try to properly pronounce. I will admit, and if there are any Jewish ears, I'm sure they're deeply offended. I will admit that I'm not pronouncing it properly. But this is the origin of the festival of Hanukkah. The lamps, okay. a lampstand was a very important part of the holy place in the tabernacle, and it was something that was part of what was restored by the Jewish priests when they retook the temple. The lampstand has a lot to do with this concept of the festival of lights. The Hanukkah is also known as the festival of lights. Now, the lampstand had a very important, again, very important place in the tabernacle. It was in an area called the holy place. The holy place was the enclosure. There was a courtyard on the outside, and then there was an enclosed area, which was a fairly decent size. And then on the other side of that was a smaller area that was separated by a curtain. That was the Holy of Holies. So the Holy of Holies is the place where the high priest could only enter in once a year. Just outside that was the holy place. And in the holy place, among a few other items, was a lampstand. A lampstand with seven branches on it. It's commonly known as a menorah. So the menorah was part of the area in the tabernacle, in the holy place in the tabernacle, that was restored along with the rest of the temple. We want to focus a bit on this menorah. Turn back to Exodus chapter 37. Exodus chapter 37. Verses 17 through 24 describe the care with which the lampstand was to be built, was to be made. Notice in verse 22, Exodus 37, Exodus 37, verse 17. Exodus 37, verse 17. It's describing various aspects of the tabernacle. Verse 17 says, "He also," that is the craftsman, "also made the lampstand of pure gold. Of hammered work he made the lampstand." So this was not some cheap little piece of furniture. It was a very valuable and very beautiful handcrafted lampstand, which included seven candles, which had a place on it for seven candles. I'm not going to read the rest of this, but it describes in some detail the care and the precision that was used to build this lampstand. Let's look at Leviticus chapter 24. Leviticus chapter 24. Verse 3. Leviticus 24, verse 3. Well, we begin in verse 1. "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Command the children of Israel that they bring to you pure oil of pressed olives for the light, to make the lamps burn continually. Outside the veil of the testimony in the tabernacle of meeting, Aaron shall be in charge of it from evening until morning before the Lord continually. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. He shall be in charge of the lamps on the pure gold lampstand before the Lord continually.'" So this lampstand, again, very carefully crafted and made of pure gold, was the responsibility of Aaron, or of the high priest. And it was to burn every night, all night. The high priest was responsible for the maintenance and the care of the lamps. And since they were fueled by oil, he would fill their reservoir with a very special oil that was only to be used in the lampstand. So the lamp was to burn all night long in the holy place within the tabernacle. Now, the lampstand was the only source of light in the holy place. The candles were to burn throughout the night so that there would not be darkness in the holy place in the tabernacle. And one of the high priest's responsibilities was to be in charge of or to care for them, to maintain those lamps on that candlestick. Now let's look at Exodus 27, verse 20. Exodus chapter 27. And Exodus 27 is also a section of this book where there's instruction given on how to build the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 27, verse 20. And you shall command the children of Israel that they bring you pure oil of pressed olives for the light, to cause the lamp to burn continually. In the tabernacle of meeting outside the veil, which is before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall tend it from evening until morning before the Lord. It will be a statute forever to their generations on behalf of the children of Israel. This is similar to what we saw in Leviticus 24. Maybe a little bit more detail here. There were the people of Israel were to provide a very pure processed oil that is to be used for the light. And it is to be, the lamp again is to burn continually within the tabernacle. And it says from evening until morning. So again, all night long, every night, this lamp was to be lit. And it was to provide light inside the holy place, which is outside the veil of testimony, or outside the veil that separates the Holy of Holies. So we find some pretty specific details about this lampstand that is to be part of the tabernacle, and then later part of the temple, and which was restored by the Jewish priests at this time. Now, according to Jewish tradition, when the priests cleansed the temple, they found only one undefiled container of oil that could be used in the lampstand, in this golden lamp. It was enough to last for one day. But it would take a week to carefully purify and refine the oil that was to be used for the lamps. They had one day supply. It would take another week to properly purify oil for the lamps. Miraculously, the flame of the lamp continued for 8 days, which was long enough for a new supply of oil to be prepared for this holy use. Hanukkah celebrates this miracle. And again, this is why it is also known as the Festival of Lights, the candles that were in the golden lampstand. Now, interestingly, the lampstand in the tabernacle had 7 candles. The traditional menorah, with the one candle in the center and then a set of 3 on each side. The Hanukkah menorah has 9 candles. They use a different kind of menorah for the celebration of Hanukkah. So it has 1 in the center and then 4 on each side. The 9th branch, the one in the center, is called the helper or the servant candle. The 9th branch is the helper or servant candle. This is the candle that's used to light the others. So, on the first night, the helper candle is lit, and then it is used each day to light one more candle on this 9-candle menorah. Again, this is to represent the miracle of the oil lasting for 8 days or 8 nights instead of just one. Initially, by the way, there was some bit of discussion or maybe even controversy. Some felt that what you should do is light all of the candles and then put one out each night or each day as you proceed through the celebration. But they settled on the approach of lighting one per day. And interestingly, it's the same fire. If this helper candle continues to burn, and it is used to start each of the other candles, then really it's the same fire that is lighting all of the candles. So as Jews observe Hanukkah, they have in their homes this 9-candle candelabra, this Hanukkah menorah, and they light one candle each day. As they light the candles, they have a special prayer. The following blessing is asked as each candle is lit. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who wrought miracles for our fathers in days of old. Basically, just a real simple statement, but acknowledging God for his miracles and his care for them. Different families would have different traditions as they observe Hanukkah. Generally speaking, it's accompanied by the singing of traditional songs, songs of praise, taking time to remember the miracles of God, as this statement, this little short prayer, it mentions. And also one of the traditions is the eating of latkes, which is a potato pancake fried in oil. It's a traditional food that the Jews enjoy as they observe Hanukkah. Now, we don't celebrate Hanukkah, and we're not going to. But there's no indication, again, in John 10, that Jesus, who was in Jerusalem at the time of this celebration, there's no indication that he condemned it. It was happening around him. He didn't say anything that we know, that's not recorded, at least, about it. If anything, I think we might relate Hanukkah to something like Thanksgiving, where it's a day that has some religious connotation, but does not have any pagan baggage to it, no pagan origin. And it's a day that we can participate in. And Hanukkah would be something along that same line in terms of the how it's celebrated and how the Jews view it. So what does all this have to do, if anything, with us? What might we take from this example that we see of this miracle and now the observance of the Feast of Dedication, the Feast of Hanukkah, the Feast of Festival of Lights? A couple of points we might consider as we look on this story. The first point that I would make is that this will happen again. This will happen again. Maybe not in the exact way, but let's look at what Jesus said in Matthew 24. Matthew chapter 24. Beginning back in verse 4, Jesus starts to give a description of things that would happen as the time of the end progresses. It's a period of time, he says in verse 8, that are the beginning of sorrows, be followed by persecution, continuing lawlessness, concluding with the thought that this gospel will be preached to all nations as a witness, and then the end will come. So all these events that he's talked about to this point are preludes to the end, which comes following those events. Verse 15, says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." He then goes on to describe, after having introduced the beginning of sorrows, this event, which will be a trigger for events of the end of the age. What happened in 167 to 164 BC was a taste, a prelude, of what will happen at the end of the age. What happened in Jerusalem in that time was a horrific thing. There was terrible suffering, persecution, and devastation of the people of God at that point. But what will happen at the end of the age is even more of a catastrophe. It says that if Jesus didn't intervene, no one would survive. No one would survive unless Jesus Christ were to intervene. Verse 22, "Unless those days were shortened, and no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." He promises that for the sake of his people, those who are his chosen, his elect, those days will not be allowed to continue to the point where the whole or all of mankind is destroyed. Now, there's not a lot of detail here, but we see that faithful Christians at the end of the age will face intense persecution and will need the kind of strength that the faithful Jews expressed. That's a new one. Those events will come, it says, at the end of the age, and it will begin with the desecration of the temple by the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of by Daniel. Again, there's not a lot of detail that's given here, but it does indicate that those events that took place before were a foretaste of what is going to happen in the future. Now, we cannot ignore the possibility that those things could happen in our lifetime. First of all, when those events begin to happen, there is a need for understanding. I skipped over one part of verse 15. "The abomination will stand in the holy place, as spoken by Daniel the prophet. Whoever reads, let him understand." Now, there's some question as to whether those were words that were spoken by Christ or whether they were words that were added by Matthew when he recorded the gospel. But the point is that whoever witnesses these things, reads of them, needs to understand what is happening. We need to have understanding. We need to be, Jesus warns in this same chapter that we always need to watch and be vigilant. Verse 44. Jesus warned in Luke 21 that those who become distracted will be caught in the same trap as everyone else in the world when events begin to take place. I thought it was interesting that the board of directors had a discussion, and we saw part of it, about how to prepare the church for severe persecution that may come in our time. That's a very sobering thought. And frankly, it caught the board of directors a little bit by surprise. And they didn't have a lot of discussion right at that moment. A couple of them said they really hadn't thought about it in those terms. But the point is, as they did discuss to some extent, those circumstances will come about. That's part of the prophecy. Will they come about in our time? That's a matter that we'll see as time passes. But it is something that we need to give thought to recognize that times of severe persecution will come upon the church at the end of the age. Notice verse 25. After giving this prophecy, Jesus says, "See, I've told you beforehand." In other words, look, I told you so. You've been warned. You've been told these events will happen. And he gives this warning, this description, so that faithful Christians, when those events happen, will be able to handle. They'll be prepared for them. They'll recognize what is happening. They will have understanding. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 17, Peter makes a similar comment at the conclusion of his chapter about the day of the Lord and the events that will take place at the end of the age. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 17 says, "You therefore, beloved, since you know this beforehand, beware lest you also fall from your own steadfastness." The end of the age prophecy has one primary purpose. And that is to help those be prepared who will be faced with those circumstances. So Jesus referred to the prophecies in Daniel, stating that they will happen at the end of the age. So that's one connection that we have to the lessons of the Feast of Dedication. Another connection we have, or another point we might consider, is the example of courage and determination that the Jews expressed. The example of courage and determination, in spite of the most excruciating, mentally, emotionally, and physically, most excruciating persecution, they stood faithful to their beliefs. They did not compromise. Now, it says in Daniel 8, verse 12, we read this a bit ago, that these terrible events occurred because of transgression. So the people of Judah were not entirely faithful to their covenant with God. And if you read more about this history, you'll see that there were some, maybe many, Jews who did compromise, who gave in to the pressure, who were not faithful. But on the other hand, there is record of those who did stand up to it, those who suffered terribly in order to maintain their belief and their faithfulness to God. So they give an example of God's people under fire and their determination to obey even in times of extreme persecution. We also can consider that God did limit this situation. He miraculously intervened on behalf of his people. He did not let them be totally destroyed, but he let them recover. He let them rebuild the temple. God used Judas Maccabees, the hammer, to defeat the Syrian armor, so that the temple could be cleansed. And it seems very likely, although it's a tradition, but it seems very likely that God did miraculously allow the one-day supply of oil to last 8 days. So the point is that, as he has in the past, God in the future will continue to perform miracles to preserve his people, even when they are suffering persecution. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 7 and take a look at a little little word picture here that we find in this prophecy. Daniel chapter 7. Start in verse 9. Daniel 7, verse 9. Now, this is kind of a little aside sort of a thought or part of the vision that Daniel was seeing. Daniel 7, verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated. So he has a view of the throne of God and God being seated on his throne. His garment was white as snow, and his hair, his head, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. There are a couple of other instances in Scripture where there's a verbal description or written description of God's throne. And as you read them, you can get maybe some bit of an inkling or a picture of what God's throne is like. But really, words cannot express the power, the majesty, the glory of the throne of God. But we see a bit of an insight here in this description. It says, 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. These are his angels who are at his throne. And they're serving him, coming before him. Who knows how many angels God created? How many angels are there? This seems to indicate that Daniel in his vision saw millions of them at the throne. God most likely uses, the word angel comes from a word that means messenger. God sends his angels to serve his people on God's behalf. And as far as we know, they can provide some assistance and they carry out God's will in people's lives as God delegates certain responsibilities to them. And there are millions of angels that God has and that he uses to care for his people. Exactly what do they do? What does God do? It would be interesting to find out someday how all this really comes together and how it works. But here's the picture that Daniel has of that throne. And then it says, the court was seated and the books were opened. It's kind of a formal setting, like a courtroom, where God is holding forth to make his decisions in how he will rule, how he will conduct his plan on his earth. He has the angels that are working with him and for him, and he's seated at his throne, and he is making decisions that affect mankind. The books, what books are opened? The books of Scripture, perhaps, the book of life, perhaps. God is working with whatever he uses to conduct and to perform his work and his plan. Now let's drop down to verse 26. No, actually, I want to start in verse 23, I'm sorry. Verse 23 talks about the fourth beast is a kingdom that will be different and will be very brutal. And it will be 10 kings, verse 24. This is that last resurrection or iteration of the Holy Roman Empire. It's the fourth beast, the one that is at the very end of the age that Jesus will defeat. Verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and seasons. Then the saints will be given into his hand for a time, time, and half a time. This is the kind of thing that the board was discussing. The difficulties, the challenges that the church will face at the end of the age are going to be, again, extreme and difficult. And God's people are given into his hand, the hands of Satan, frankly. Verse 26, but the court was seated. God called things to order. He determined and made decisions on what is going to happen and how this evil power will be dealt with. The court will be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. God will convene his angels, and he will dispatch them to do his work, and they will destroy, ultimately, this evil power. Now, we know in Revelation 19, a little different picture of how things will transpire at the end of the age and how that fourth kingdom will ultimately be destroyed. But when the court is seated and the decision is made and the power is taken away, verse 27, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions will serve and obey him. God has always miraculously intervened on behalf of his people. And as this is not the last place in the Bible, but it tells you what the ultimate conclusion is going to be. The good guys are going to win. And they'll be given not a white hat, but white robes of righteousness, and will rule with Jesus Christ. He will miraculously intervene on behalf of his people. The candlestick itself, of course, has significance because of the light that it projects. So we'll look quickly at one more area, explore one more area of what we can learn from this observance of Hanukkah. That is the significance of the candlestick. Jesus Christ said in John chapter 8, verse 12, that he is the light of the world. He's the light of the world. He made this statement in the general context of the observance of the Feast of Hanukkah. And it's interesting, when Jesus had this confrontation with the Jews in John chapter 10, that during the Festival of Lights, the Jews proved that they were living in darkness because they did not recognize or understand or honor the Messiah. Jesus Christ stands among the candlesticks in Revelation chapter 1, verse 3, and also verse 13, and also verse 20. There's a candlestick in this vision in Revelation 1 that represents each one of the churches. The candlesticks in Revelation 1 are fueled not by a special concoction of olive oil, but fueled by the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit fuels the people, the churches of God, who are represented by these candlesticks. Matthew 5, verse 14 says that we are to be the light of the world. Where we go, God's truth shines. We show an example. We show the way. We're like a city at night on a hillside. It cannot be missed. Candlesticks, light, very important to God, to his people. The Festival of Lights is a reminder of a dramatic event in the history of Judah. As I said, we can think about it and recognize it and learn from it. We're not going to observe Hanukkah, but it is certainly something that we can learn from. Their history of that event, the events that led to it, can remind us of our need for courage and for faithfulness. Jesus warned that the real fulfillment of the prophecies in Daniel of this desecration of the temple will take place at the end of the age. And again, he concludes this portion of the prophecy by saying, look, I told you beforehand. So that we can be God's people in this time when these events will take place, can be prepared and can have understanding and can maintain their faithfulness, their confidence, and their continued obedience to God, even in the most difficult of circumstances. We can learn some important lessons as we consider and look at this brief history of the Feast of Dedication.
Thank you, Mr. Henson.